Hello, Mustang fans, and welcome to another Ford Performance edition of the Mustang Owners Podcast. I'm John Clore, Enthusiast Communications Manager for Ford Performance, along with my co-host Mike Ray, President of the Mustang Owners Club of Southeastern Michigan, or MOXM, and the International Council of Mustang Clubs. You know, Mike and I have long said that everyone has a Mustang story, so that's why we work to bring you the inside stories behind all the cool cars, clubs, collectors, and the characters in this incredible Mustang hobby that we enjoy so much. And Mike, again, when we talk about enjoyment, we got another very special episode tonight that features a Mustang hero that no one will ever forget, even though he keeps a very low profile.
Yeah, absolutely. A great and genuine guy, and we're going to have some fun tonight.
Well, at a MOXM meeting, if you see this guy sit next to you, you'd never know that he was a designer of the fourth generation Mustang, being the chief guy in charge of this styling exercise, and working with such luminaries as John Colletti, the people that rescued the fourth generation Mustang, and Emmeline King, who we've had on the podcast, worked under this gentleman for working the interior of this fourth gen car. Tonight we're going to be talking to Bud Magaldi, the chief designer on that beautiful fourth generation SN95 Mustang. Bud, welcome to the Mustang Owners Podcast.
Well, thank you, John, and thank you, Gerard, and thank you, Mike, for being there. And I just heard Art's commentary before, and it was beautiful. Art's a great guy and a good engineer, and we were glad to have him on the SN95 program as well.
Well, the reason why I really wanted you on the podcast, but, and I know that you had a wonderful podcast with the late Steve Hall, but now the Mustang is turning 60 this year, and it's time to reflect a little bit, not on just where we think it could be going in the future, which is a whole nother podcast, but also the people that really guided this car along the way, and you were certainly one of those. But what really intrigued me is I first started talking to you back when I caused a big ruckus on FordPerformance.com by showing a piece of four photographs that I, when the Ford Archives moved from its old building down at Ford Racing into the beautiful old engineering building on Oakwood. Dean Weber was the head of archives back then, and he found four photos behind a file cabinet. And one of them was a picture of a mid-engine, looked like a 66 Mustang coupe, but clearly a motor was behind the back, in the back seat. And it was in a Ford studio. And I had written a piece saying, hey, help us determine what this car is. And see, what I do is try to do interactive content on Ford Performance to get readers involved. And I got a million people answering. And then, of course, somebody, I think it was Jalopnik or one of these online places went on and called Ford PR, who called Archives, and they had the answer. Well, unfortunately, they called you, which is cheating. You can't do that and call Ford. I wanted them to tell me what it is, not go call Ford and then Ted Ryan scaring you up. This was one of those prototypes for the Mach 2. It wasn't the Mach 2. It was not, because the steel tubing was different on the Mach 2. But and then when you let the cat out of the bag, there goes my beautiful story. It was only 2 days in, and they said, we've solved it. They never called me, of course. And I got myself in a heap of trouble. And I thought, how could Bud Magaldi do this to me? Bud Magaldi was my friend. But I had no idea you were working on Mustang way back then. When did you start?
I started in early 66, and right almost immediately worked on a Mustang. I did a my first assignment, by the way, before I even get to that part, when you get to Ford as a designer, you have a training program you attend, and it really puts you through all the different studios for about 2.5 years before you become a full-fledged designer. But when I first got there, the first thing I did, my boss had me do a full-size tape drawing of a 64 Mustang, 64 and a half or 65 Mustang. And we were already working on the 67 by then. And I asked him why we were doing it. And I believe he thought it was for marketing purposes when it came to the 67, when they do a full-size rendering of that car and put them together and see what the differences are. But that was my first thing. The second thing was the second thing was actually going to the Mark II, the mid-engine car.
Mm-hmm.
That was done in secret in the basement of the design center, right by the big elevator that was right. But there was only two stories, I believe, in that elevator. And basement was one of them. And we were doing it right there because I don't think we had funding for it. And there was only about four guys involved, maybe a couple of modelers, plus Bob Hazzard, myself, and Jerry Morrison, who was the designer of the car itself, and a few modelers to do a clay model based on that chassis that looked like a Mustang, which was. And if you overlay the two, you'll see. And that's what I did for Ryan, Ted Ryan. And I was called, by the way, from Jim Farrell to give him that information. We were talking about it, and he said, "Do you still have that?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." And I had the photographs and everything, so I sent some of those along as well. But anyway, that car was a mid-engine, two-seater car, and it was built. It's a fiberglass model. I don't know if it ever ran, but it may have. I wasn't on it long enough to see it. I saw it complete as a complete car, but not. I can't remember if it was a runner or not. I suspect it was not, but it wasn't a Mustang chassis and the Fox body. Yeah, and and what was nice about it is I really liked the proportion of the car.
Of course you did. But Mike, isn't it weird? You talk to Art Hyde and the engineering side, and they do things on a shoestring budget, and then you talk to Bud McGaldy on the design side, and they've got a shoestring budget. Who's got the budgets around there?
Well,
it ain't you.
I'll tell you, you have to remember, when I first signed up with Ford, I graduated from Art Center College of Design, and Ford was the first one to interview me. I didn't go to GM or Chrysler to even interview. I said I took the job right away because I wanted to work for a family-owned company. And you have to remember, they were a family car company. They only built family-type cars except for the Thunderbird, which was a little more of a luxury family car, but that was their biggest luxury car. You know, they didn't think about mid-engine cars or anything like that at that point in time in the early mid-60s. But they focused more on the family car. And I was surprised that we were even doing a Mustang mid-engine car in the basement.
Well, a lot of crazy things went on down there. And Mike, I'm not sure if you remember, I told you when I got myself in trouble and challenging what Dean Weber had given me. But I tell you what, Charlie Henry, a local journalist, tracked that car down. Apparently somebody said it was still in a barn somewhere or in a garage somewhere in Dearborn Heights, and had a photo of it in the book that that he had written about cars and concepts. And he said, you know, there's a lot of people at Ford that remember these cars, and the only way to track them is to talk to the guys that were there. And Bud, I can't tell you how that surprised me that you had been doing that for so long, because the Fox body came out, and then we all thought that after 10 years that would be the end of Fox body, but then it got to be 11, and then it got to be 12, you know. And I thought, well, maybe they're making up that the two only ran 5 years, so they're going to add the extra five to the Fox body, because we were just thinking every 10 years we'd get a new generation. So what were you doing between the time you were working with Bob Aitkins and he was doing the SVO until you got the nod to jump into SN95?
Well, I've done and worked with a lot of different cars, but my Mustang experiences were that one there, the red Mark II, not the white one. It was looked like a short 64 and a half.
Right, right.
But the next project I got right after that was working with Charlie McCoes and Pete Stacy and Keith Teeter on one of the 350s and GT 500s for 68. And what they gave me, because I was just I was only going to be there for a couple of months. They didn't want a 3 or 4 months, and they didn't want to do what some of these smaller things that had to be done for that car. And so they gave me the assignment, which one of them, I think, turned out to be an icon, if you ask me. But I just realized that not too long ago. And I'll tell you why, because it was to do take the two-dimensional Shelby Cobra picture with the 350 underneath it, or the 500 underneath it. And it was just a plaque. And they said to me, what can you do with that? And I said, why don't we make it three-dimensional? And they suggested, I think they were hinting at it anyway. So they said, make it three-dimensional. And they said, okay. So I worked with the guy in the shop, in the metal shop, and we carved out this model out of aluminum of the snake, the cobra snake, just the way you saw
it. Cobra snake, Bud, when you told that to Moxham, Mike, do you remember people, the jaws are dropping, that Bud Nigaldi did that first coiled snake that we all know is now so familiar with Shelby. Bud, I know you probably thought that was a menial job, but...
It was. I mean, that's what they thought. I thought it was pretty cool myself, because I was just starting. I wanted to design something, you know.
But the snake? Come on!
Yeah, and then I also did the roll bar for the convertible version, which they carried that through for many years. And when we did the 94, the SN95, and we did the pace car, and we had a roll bar for the pace car version that we were putting out. We used the same roll bar design that we used on the very first one, only we made it a little more form to the interior, a little more curvature on it, because it was more aerodynamic than the original.
Well, we know that once you got onto that team, and you know, someone smarter than all the other people at the company decided, hey, why don't we put a group together and see if they can save this car? They stuck you over at the Dano Technical Center, the old Montgomery Ward's area down on Allen Park there, and you guys were off on your own. You know, that's where the Skunk Works idea came from. And when you were there, I know, Mike, when you first saw SN95, some of the renderings after it was launched, what was the club's reaction? Were you, what did you think? Because you're a Fox Body guy, you owned a SVO. What was the general feeling of the Mustang owners in Michigan once they saw that car?
That's the 95 you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think everybody was just worried about losing Mustang in general, right? So, you know, we wanted that the tradition to continue in the history. And yeah, I mean, I think everybody, this is true to any launch, you know, when they first see the new car, it's like, how excited are they? Or they're going to try to pick it apart. We've seen it with the S197. We've seen it with the 550. And but everybody grows to love it, and then it becomes an icon in its own. So my favorite cars for the SN95s are, I love the Woodward Edition Mustang. I love the Saleen Mustangs, and I also love my favorite is the Terminators.
Well, for us, Bud, you got to really understand. I know, I think you came to a Moxham meeting once, and someone asked you this question, but Mike Gray got himself into a bunch of hot water when he went to a launch as an insider. They brought in some Mustang Club people, and Mike happened to be involved. He's standing looking over a new Mustang model, and some Ford guy was next to him, and he said, hey, what do you think? And Mike, not knowing who this Ford guy was, said, oh, I like everything except I hate the taillights.
Yeah, that was the refresh. It was the 2010 model. We were invited there in 2009 for the refresh, and
yeah, who was asking you that?
Dave Parasek, Mustang chief engineer.
Yeah, so, he didn't like the taillights on the tri-bar horizontal.
On the 10. On the 2010, 10. I did not like them, no.
He didn't like how they changed them. And so Mike had to chase down, was it Daryl Beamer? And we had to, oh my gosh. And when Bud Nigaldi showed up at the Moxham meeting, of course, the first question was, Bud, can you explain why you came out with a Mustang in 1994 and you came out with three horizontal.
Yeah, it's not a vertical, yeah.
We got a lot of feedback on that, John.
Well, your explanation, I never heard an explanation, because how many times you get to talk to a Mustang designer, and in fact, the one who did it, and your explanation after you said it made a lot of sense about that body line across the whole car. And I went and looked at it. If you talked, yes, it did kind of carried right through the taillight. I didn't notice that.
Yep, it did. The character line at the upper part of the door and body went right around the back of the car and all the way back around to the other front end. And that was basically the driver for the horizontal taillights.
Right.
Only because we wanted to capture you. We wanted your eye to flow around the car and not stop at something vertical. It was at that point, although it was more traditional to go to the three bar yes. taillights vertically.
Yep.
We thought, let's change it up a little bit because this is an all new car. And we thought, let's give it a little bit of a little more exciting look to it to make it look wider, number one. And because mm-hmm. those taillights wrap around a bit, so it does look a bit wider. And I mean, it's all psychological, I think. But in most cases, we thought it would look better if we kept that theme flowing around the car like that.
Well, in your defense, in one part of the year.
That's right.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It was a Motor Trend Car of the Year.
Absolutely.
It was the second one, too. The first one was a Mark II.
Yep.
The only other Mustang. I don't know if the later ones have made it. There must be.
The Mustang II was Car of the Year.
Yeah.
In 1974. But I got to tell you, Bud, just as Art is talking about when the ST16 was going to be the probe was going to be the Mustang, and here's a VP saying you can't make a front wheel drive Japanese car and call it a Mustang. There were people in Mike's club, and Mike, you probably know some of them, who looked at Bud's design on the 94 Mustang and said, "You can't make a Mustang with three horizontal taillights. Where are our vertical?"
And we still get that question today about it, but now hearing the explanation from Bud, we get to translate that to them.
So, Bud, how did you find out that the public, I mean, you were actually went back and redesigned it for 96.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what we had planned on doing that anyway, because most of the designers even wanted vertical taillights. But we thought, let's face it, we changed the engine to it at the same time, you know?
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. what's a Mustang without a 5-liter engine?
There you go.
Know? I mean, you could ask the same question to that, you know?
Well, when Mike Ray started his rapping career and was rolling in his 5.0.
That's right.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody's ever heard Mike Ray do any rapping, but if you have, call me.
Yeah, but that's the same philosophy, you know? I mean, if it's not a 5-liter, is it really a Mustang, you know?
Yeah, that's – that brings us to some of the things we talked to Art about and that team. Was there ever a moment when you were working on SN95 and you didn't have a lot of people, and Art told me you didn't have very much money. But when you were working on it, was there ever a moment where you thought, we're going to do our damnedest and our best to get this up to having somebody look at it, and maybe it might not make it? Did you ever feel that way?
No, never felt it wouldn't be successful as far as the design went. First of all, we were going from the market was changing at that point. If you remember, all those boxy K-car type cars were going away slowly, including the previous Mustang, which was not super dynamic, but it looked dynamic. I mean, aerodynamic, but it looked aerodynamic. And we thought we want to soften it up a little bit because Jack Telnak wanted to pursue the aero look a little further than what we had done on the T-Bird and on the Lincoln, the Mark 7, which I also worked on, and also the Taurus I worked on, the original Taurus. I was the principal designer of that car. I took some of what I learned from the Taurus and put that into the Mustang too, and the Mustang also, I should say.
Yeah, well, and, talking to John Clorier.
Yeah, I know.
And I don't have
I'm
any.
I'm glad I'm talking and not you, John.
Well, let me just say, Mike is the one guy that hasn't thrown me under the bus. You know, before he was president at Moxham, I pull into they had to show up at Wilson Barn, and if you showed up with a Mustang too, they'll go, "Oh yeah, you can come in, but you got to park over there by the dumpster next to the Edsel." See, that's why.
Oh no!
I knew I had to be the champion of this poor little thing. But no, with you, Bud, that brings up another point. A lot of people who claimed to be Ford people, and Mustang people claimed, I think, the most about being Ford people, don't really fully realize the absolute importance of that Taurus on the history of Ford. It was a make or break car. It likely saved Ford Motor Company. So not only were you involved with the little team that saved the Mustang, but that Taurus, when it came out, completely changed the financial future of Ford, giving it the number one selling car in America and putting Toyota on the defense, thinking, we got to figure out how to, from that Taurus came the Camry. And you guys completely changed Ford's future with that runaway success story. What an accomplishment when you think back, you know, you're out in Florida, you're talking to your friends and say, hey, wait a second. Not only did I do SN95 and make Mike Ray happy by changing the taillights, but you touched the Taurus too?
Well, the interesting part about that was that car came out also with flush glass on the side. You know, it was one of our first American cars to do that. We had taken a BMW 635, I think it was, which had flush glass, and an Audi A6 as mule cars to look at to see how they did it. And we thought, we have to do something very aerodynamic with this car. And one thing is, let's get rid of all of the drip rails and all that stuff and make a car that has flush glass. Wow. And it was interesting because Bob Tasca came to the studio one time and he told me, he said, you'll never get flush glass on that car, bud. And I said, well, I think we will, Bob. And he made a statement that I'm not going to say here because it was a little bit off color. But but anyway, at the end of the day, when he saw me again, he had to relent and say, yep, you did it.
You know? Son of a gun, Magaldi.
Yeah. But it was funny that if we were dead set against anything else other than flush glass. And again, it was Jack Kalanick pushing the buttons on all of these cars that were aerodynamic. And I give him a lot of credit for letting us just be ourselves and do our job, you know. And then also what happened with that car, when they have one in the museum at Henry Ford. And when they first put the display together, my granddaughter was there with her class. And they were looking at the Taurus display and looking at the car. And she looked up and there was a picture of two designers standing at a drawing board. And she said, that's my papa. That's neat. So I said, wait a minute, I can't be an antique piece yet.
Wait a minute, you're in a museum?
I was. They took that display down because they needed it for other stuff. But after many years, though, it was up there for a lot of years. But
well, we're going to, Mike, let's call over to Mr. Anderson and see if we can get that for Bud's man cave in his basement.
Exactly.
I put that in my basement, too, man cave like that.
That is too cool. Well, Bud, the reason we wanted to bother you tonight so much is, you know, we talk about 60 years of Mustang. A lot of you guys that worked on these cars, and you've worked on several of them, all those generations. Did you ever think, even now in retirement, that you're going to get to the point where you're going to see Mustang hit 60 years of continuous production?
Well, I never thought I would, but, you know, it seemed like we just did 50 years not too long ago. And I still don't feel any older, so I don't know what's going on with that. But
how is that?
But we did 50 years. It seems like a few years.
It was like yesterday, doesn't it?
I think back at the SN95 being 30 years ago, you know, that's half 60. And I think, where did that time go to? You know, it happened so fast. But I think when you're always thinking ahead for some reason, you know, designers have a tendency to think beyond where they are right now. And I think that's what happens is the time just flies because you're not thinking about what happened before. You're trying to think about what the new thing is coming out, you know?
Well, a part of Mustang's lore has always been fun. And what's the saying, Mike? Time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah. I just can't believe how quick those last 10 years have really went by.
Well, Mike, I don't know. We talked about your event. It was on the grounds of the Greenfield Village. What was the name of that place, Mike? The Ford Conference and Event Center or something?
Yeah, CEC, Conference Event Center, yeah.
Okay, and then I don't know, Bud, if you recall, Mike was not happy with nothing really big enough going on in Detroit for the Mustang 50th anniversary, mm-hmm. because Ford was doing things in Charlotte and Las Vegas with the MCA. So he took it upon himself and damn near bankrupted his club to put on this big party where he had five vice presidents at one table. He called everybody and anybody.
Oh, yeah.
And to come out and spend an evening with just celebrating. And that autograph line went from, was it 8 o'clock? Or
yeah.
Yeah.
It went a long time. All I know is I had writer's cramp after that.
But we did not leave that building until 2:30 in the morning. If you remember, yeah. that next morning was Woodward Dream Cruise. So we were all there at 5 or 6. Yeah. So we went home, took a shower, and got dressed and went back out.
That's crazy. That was crazy. But I'll tell you what, I couldn't wait to quit signing autographs and go get some signed by some of the people that were there, because there were some icons there that I think were heroes. And yeah. You guys were amongst those guys in my book. And as far as I'm concerned, the Mustang Owners Club of Southeast Michigan is above and beyond what I ever expected a car club to be. And now I understand why, after going to some of those meetings and being there with you guys. And it's been a heck of a ride to see the passion. There isn't one person in that room that I ever spoke to that didn't do something different with their car to personalize it, you know?
Yeah.
No matter what year it was, it didn't matter. Yeah. He did something to personalize that car. And you don't do that unless you really love that thing, you know?
Yeah.
Mike, what was the year you had 1,000 cars at headquarters? Was it 14?
Oh, we did it three times. It was 2011, 12 at headquarters. And then in 14, we did it at PDC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And remember one of Bud's friends, that guy named Gail Halderman?
Oh, yeah.
He came out, and I'd made friends with him for a few years. We had so much fun together, and I was so happy to see him show up. You know, he had his sunglasses on and his golf hat, thought nobody would recognize him. Mm-hmm. So I went up to him, and I put my arm around Gail, and I said, look at this. And Mike, we were standing up just looking over the entire show field, and you came up with your VP and I think Ziggy or a couple other guys on the board. And I said to Gail, look at this, Gail, 1,000 Mustangs. I mean, consider this, had you drawn a turd, no one would be here.
Yeah.
True story.
Yeah.
And Jenny, Bud, as you know, my wife, she said, John, you can't say that. And Gail, as you know, Bud, was a character.
Well, Gail was, the first time I ever met Gail, I almost fell over myself because he was a real icon. And before I even knew him, only because I knew he had worked on the first Mustang and was responsible for it from a design standpoint. And he's always been I kind of looked up to him. And I loved working with him and for him. When I was going through the process of being a design executive, but he was such a great, he was one of the people that you so laid back, you would never know he was the guy that did that car.
Yeah. Yeah. It was not pretentious.
Never talked about himself. Believe me, yeah. Never did.
And what a great guy. You know, Mike, we did lose a great friend with Gail, but what a great thing it is that the family decided to keep his barn museum going, and his daughter Karen and his granddaughter Lauren do such a great job down there. And that's why, Bud, when you and Bob Akins came down and just took over the Moxum, Mike, you go down there usually in August or September as a club, and having Bud McGaldy, one time, Bud, I think you were at a show somewhere in either Cincinnati or Dayton, and you rolled by and we were having another cruise in there, and you just, I mean, you signed autographs there for an hour.
I've done a lot of that, John, and I don't know. And, you know, it's like I say, the Mustang wouldn't exist today if it wasn't for the passion and the dedication of the members of Mustang car clubs around the country. You know, I mean, they kept this whole thing going and kept it being an icon. That car could have been a Probe.
Yep.
And, you know, but when you think about it, this is the interesting part. The car, when we first came out, it was a beautiful car, proportionally perfect, at a low price.
Right.
And now, who would have thought then that you could buy a Mustang for $300,000?
You know? Right.
Yeah, Mike.
And, you know, think about it. And you know, John, can I give my quote here to follow up?
And they'll probably sell every one of them. That they
The 60 years of Mustang, we've been asking everybody what it means to them. And my response was 60 years of Mustang means that the following and the love for the iconic car has never died. It has created a worldwide family of people and owners to celebrate the Mustang each and every year for the last 60 years. And there's no end in sight.
Yeah, and there's none. And the price doesn't deter anybody.
Well,
no.
Just because a current Mustang GT costs more than my first house doesn't bother me, because we have inflation. You know, that's what I'm saying.
You can still get a nice Mustang GT for low 50s, John. I mean, a really nice option one.
Yeah. Jenny and I bought our first house for $58,000.
Anyway, yeah, so I bought my first house for $50,000. I know.
There you go. So anyway, so I don't want that to bother. I mean, don't get frustrated about that. That's a Ford decision. And I think, Bud, I think you just hit the nail on the head that Ford can decide what to build and how to price it and all that with the Mustang. And thank God we've had people like you and Art and Gail and Telnick and all the great heroes.
And Buck.
Yeah, but let me tell you, you're right. It's the people who they decide what they celebrate. They decide what they buy. They decide how to party, and they own the hobby. And without them, Mike, and we have to thank you for your years of dedication in the clubs, and all you listening out there who are members of clubs that actually work to put together these wonderful events that we can enjoy these cars, because Bud didn't draw them to be put on a piece of paper. I know, Bud, you love to go see these cars that people have years after you've drawn them and see them at shows and how much they love them.
Oh, yeah. It's always fun to look at something that you've done and that somebody that owns it has a passion for it. And that means you struck a note with them with this design. Generally, it's the looks of the car that get them in the showroom. And then when they find out what the engineering part is, it just draws them right in, you know, pulls them right in. So I think that's always been the way it's been. I remember seeing the first Mustang, and I didn't know what kind of engine it had, what kind of transmission or any of that, but I sure knew what it looked like. And I thought, boy, that's going to be a success, you know?
Absolutely. I think it's human nature. I know, Mike, we've been trying to get Hal Spurlick to talk to us on the podcast, and Hal is the true father of the Mustang. It was his idea.
Oh, yeah.
And Lee did a great job selling it to get it built. Only Lee Iacocca could have got this car done. But Spurlick deciding, the only way we're going to make this is getting it onto the Falcon and just positioning this car so well and supporting Gail, who said, you've got to capture them the minute they see it. And Hal Spurlick, Bud, told me that his whole idea of marketing this car was, the first thing you'll see is, look at that car. It looks so different and so pretty and so, like you said, proportionally right as a designer, that people couldn't help but be attracted to it. And then they'd say, they had an advertisement with a blonde in a white gown. And he goes, look at that girl. If I had that car, I could get that girl. And then they put the price. He goes, oh, my God, I can afford it. He goes, that's how we marketed the Mustang. And the work you did on all the Mustangs you touch, but especially that fourth gen, which is now so many young people get that car and they're get into the hobby with that car. They drag race it, they road race it, they fix them up for the street, they restore them, they hot rod them, and then you know when they win the lottery, they buy a new one, Mike, off of
bike race. It's still affordable. It's still affordable at that. You know, it's affordable for young people to buy those cars. They're not pulling in the big bucks like some of the. Unless it's a special version of some sort.
But yeah, they are. They're very affordable, Bud, to get into the
hobby. Very affordable. And that's, if I was a young guy, when I was out looking for my first car when I was 17, that would be on my list.
Well, that brings us to knowing what Mustang means to you, Bud, over 60 years. If you, you know, you talk to your wife and you said, hey, honey, you know, I've done a lot. We've been having some fun these last few years. You know, you go to enjoy Florida when we're freezing our kazoozies off up here. And Mike, don't ask me what a kazoozie is. we're going to ask you if you could go back right now and ask your wife, hey, can I have some, let's spend some money on a Mustang. Which one would you buy right now? Your own?
Oh my God.
Somebody else's?
I was at the Ford dealer today looking at Mustangs, believe it or not, because I had
no, you weren't.
I had my car and an oil change. No, I was at the Ford dealer. Not your Ford. I'm in Florida, so
he's in Florida.
It's a little hard to see you there.
Yeah. Oh, you saw him on the showroom floor.
Yeah, Mike. If I was in town, I'd probably be at your dealership. I'm in Florida, and I had to get an oil change on my Edge. But if I was looking at one, I'm still kind of hooked on the 2015. I still like that car.
Oh, yes, 550. Yep, great. They made a movie about it, I heard, Mike.
In that movie,
when we asked Gail about it, he did say too much chlor, not enough Holderman. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the best movie, best line ever.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Bud McGaldy, we have to thank you for all your contributions. We really hope that when you're done having fun in Florida, you come back to Michigan, that you can come up and join the club for its birthday party up there on the 13th of April, and come to our meetings again. And we got to have you back on the podcast to talk about all of these great memories that you had, because this car, I mean, every day we talk to you guys and the stories you have to tell about it, it's got to just do something that you didn't get stuck just building the flush glass on an F-150 pickup. And that was your highlight of your Ford career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you one thing. That's why I like working for Ford Motor Company. It's a family-oriented company, or at least it was when I worked there, and I still believe it is, because they've really taken good care of us retirees and the people that have worked there in the past. And you read about today's stuff, and you don't see people losing this and losing that. And they stuck to their guns and said what they were going to do, and they're doing it. And we appreciate that. And we appreciate the fact, I appreciate the fact that Mustang people are still as enthusiastic as they were when the first car came out, no matter which one comes out, which year it comes out, or when it comes out.
Well, Mike, you can tell Bud for sure that we appreciate being able to interact with our heroes and the people that made this car. What would Moxham be if we didn't have this opportunity, Mike?
Right, absolutely. I mean, and that's why we treasure, you know, we're very fortunate to be in Michigan, but we treasure the relationships we have with all the Mustang heroes and being able to share these stories with the whole world, basically, yeah. And just have them in our backyard.
Well, I'm also a member and an enthusiast, yeah, of that club.
You know, yeah.
Club.
You know? Yeah, you're a lifetime member because you're one of the heroes.
Yeah, but I'm an enthusiast, and I'd be a member anyway. Once I found
that
I wanted to join anyway. So thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And I love going to the meetings because I just enjoy picking somebody to talk to and asking them about their car, you know, because every time somebody talks about a Mustang, I get the hairs on my arm raise up, you know.
Yeah.
It's just that kind of thing.
Well, Bud McGaldy, again, thank you so much for all that you've done and for being a part of our enthusiast community. We're just very lucky to have you grace us with your presence, and hopefully you'll be able to spend more time with us during the summer. You're just an absolute joy.
Well, thank you, John. I hope to see you guys on the 13th.
Yes, sir.
For
National
sure.
Mustang Day in Dearborn.
That's it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's a wrap for this edition of the Mustang Owners Podcast. But don't forget to check out the enthusiast section of FordPerformance.com this week. And if you haven't already done so, get your Mustang Club or Facebook group registered on FordPerformanceClubConnect.com. And for that matter, all of your Mustangs registered on FordSpecialVehicleRegistry.com. You can also find out what Mike's Mega Club, Moxham, is up to by visiting Moxham.com. And please make sure you're following the Mustang Owners Podcast on Spotify so you can be notified every time a new episode is uploaded. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions that you email to us at clubhub@ford.com. So until next time, we'll be looking to catch you down the road.